Da han hørte hvilke ord som kom ut av munnen hennes, hoppet hjertet hans over et slag, og et sug i magen fikk han til å legge ned McFrysen han var på vei til å spise. For han så på henne at hun mente det hun sa. Men han spurte likevel om hun var sikker, og hun nikket unnskyldende. Men egentlig så hun ikke trist ut i det hele tatt, men letta. Og da hun nikket av restauranten, tenkte han på hva han skulle ønske han hadde sagt. Og det er sånne ting som gjør at folk sitter her og gråter noen ganger. Men sånn er livet. Og McDonald's er bare en liten del av det, tross alt.
Kiwi-kunder kan spare tusenvis med Kiwi Plus. Du får 15% trumfbonus på all fersk frukt og grønt, 50% bonus på alle bleier, bind og tamponger, og 1% bonus på alt det andre. Det blir det fort penger av. Last ned appen vår og bruk bonusen i butikk, eller overført til bankkonto, og bruk på hva du vil. Vær smart du også, og gjør som over 2,2 millioner andre. Bli Kiwi Plus-kunde du også.
Ready? You have the cameras rolling?
He was hosting boozy parties in Downing Street.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I have a dream.
We will win this election, and we will change the country together.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Welcome.
Welcome.
My name is Eirik Bergesen.
And my name is Sofie Høgestøl.
And this is still our informal, personal way of glancing up from the daily news headlines, peeking into the future, and trying to present to you the big picture.
And as you can hear, we are now speaking in English.
And you might be thinking, this is Sophie's idea. She got tired of speaking Norwegian, having to avoid breaking into English. And you might expect her oppositely to break into Norwegian during this episode. But no, the reason we are speaking English is that our guest this week is English. And we are so glad to have with us a key international figure in the diplomatic effort to understand and combat global crises, most notably the war in Ukraine. This is a person I am told nobody knows more about the Security Council than you, Richard Gowen, the UN Director of the International Crisis Group. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me as your first English-speaking guest. I hope I won't be the last.
We'll see. This is an experiment.
Could be a disaster.
It's a make or break moment right here now. So you're not, however, in Norway only to speak to us. You have been speaking to government officials earlier this week.
If you work on the United Nations, as I've done for 20 years, you get to know a lot of Norwegians. It's a sort of a professional hazard. And I've been in Oslo, firstly for a conference on the Security Council, but also seeing a lot of your colleagues in the Foreign Ministry and really catching up after 3 years where we couldn't have these one-to-one contacts due to COVID.
Because we just have to add here that for those who don't know, and I think a lot of you know, you are our listeners, that Norway is a member of the UN Security Council these days, have been for, 2 years minus 4 months. We're on the last, which should have been a victory lap, but is rather the opposite in a way. It's a gloomy world out there that we're trying to manage through the Security Council.
It is a gloomy world, but you know, Norway has been on the council since the start of 2021. And actually, I think a lot of observers of the UN are glad that Norway has been on the council in this period. Norwegian diplomacy has always had a strong focus on the UN, going right back to Trygve Lie. And in a period where we've seen a war in Europe, huge tensions between the US and the Russians in New York, actually having a country like Norway on the Security Council, working on some deals, trying to get compromises on Ukraine, but also on other problems like Afghanistan and the Middle East, has been really important. And I think your team has done really well in New York.
Well, it's interesting because I do some research on the Security Council. I'm a legal academic for our international audience, and
for the international audience,
you know, who might be out there, we don't know. But I interviewed people before we went into the Security Council, and I follow the process of getting into the Security Council, which is a long-winded election campaign, which we won.
Included,
we
were very happy to win. Included a lot of waffles.
A lot of waffles. We flew out our crown prince. He DJed parties at the UN. You know, in the end, we came out victorious over, was it Canada and Ireland?
Well, Ireland got a seat as well.
Yeah.
Canada, they did actually do something with Celine Dion to try to no. counter the crown prince, but they didn't quite make it.
Well, but the interesting thing was I read some research on when Norway was in the Security Council last time around, which was around 2000-2001. And some of the academic assessments of our time in the Security Council 20 years ago was that, you know, we went in with these high ambitions. I think at the time we campaigned on, we were going to work on African issues, we were going to work on UN reform, we were going to do this and this and that. And then we get into the council, and then shortly thereafter, 9/11 happens, and that whole agenda goes out the window. And this time around, you know, we campaign on women and children in peace and conflict situation. Also, I think security or UN reform, linking green issues with security issues, like climate change with security. And then we get into the council during a pandemic, and then Ukraine. And then all of that sort of goes out the window. So I don't know what it's about Norway's times in the Security Council, but I think it's not been the 2 years we thought it was going to be.
Look, I think every country that campaigns for a seat on the Security Council makes inflated claims about what it's going to achieve. I mean, sometimes really less to satisfy diplomats in New York and more to satisfy a domestic audience, because I think the public imagines, sadly a bit inaccurately, that you can go onto the Security Council and solve climate change.
Right.
I mean, the reality is, as you know, is that the Security Council is a place where countries do dirty deals about problems where they have common interests. It's also a political theater, and we've seen a lot of political theater over Ukraine this year. But behind the scenes, as I mentioned just now, you know, Norway has been working away on some really nasty files, such as how the UN can get humanitarian aid into Afghanistan, yeah, talking to the Taliban. And despite all the noise over Ukraine, the Norwegian mission has sort of very slowly worked on that, very successfully actually worked on that, and even persuaded the Chinese and the Russians to support a continued UN presence in Afghanistan. Now, Ukraine is getting all the attention, but actually the UN can probably do more good.
Right.
Getting food, getting medicine to the Afghans. And so, I mean, I admire that sort of painstaking diplomacy by your team.
And then, so I'm going to draw a little bit on my diplomatic experience on a very low level. Having worked somewhat with peace and reconciliation, because diplomacy, unfortunately, works in that fashion. And even though we have done these things that you mentioned, Richard, and thank you for highlighting them, because I think a lot of people don't know, just following the news in Norway. However, what they do know is that we flew Taliban over here in a private jet with white leather seats, and somebody forgot to tell them not to take pictures and post them online, which created a huge diplomatic scandal
because nationally, you know, why are we flying out the Taliban in first class private jet seats, and they're like taking selfies and posting them online?
So trying to make the world a better place. Sometimes it's the devil is in the details, obviously.
I mean, are people suggesting that the Taliban should have sort of flown economy class with SAS?
I don't know.
They should be paying for their peanuts.
I think they also didn't consider the fact that they cannot do that because they're on lots of terrorist lists. There's a reason that we had to fly them in. You know, there are lots of international law reasons for why we did what we did. But for our new foreign minister at the time, this was quite difficult because she took over, she became minister in mid-October.
I think that... at least in UN circles, Norway has a good reputation for talking to bad guys. And that can be the Taliban, or it can be the guerrillas in Colombia, where, you know, you help lead the peace process. And I appreciate that that may make some people uncomfortable. But the reality is, whether you're dealing with Afghanistan, you know, or whether you're trying to get some minimal deals to mitigate the war in Ukraine, you have to talk to very unpleasant people. And, you know, Norway has a reputation, along with some other countries like Switzerland, for being able to manage those sorts of relationships. It will get you into some embarrassing situations. And it would be nice if the Taliban had better sort of like social media protocols. But I guess that wasn't a priority when they were in the mountains. But, you know, I do think it is actually one of your national strengths.
Yeah, because that's interesting. The obviously, large countries have the advantage of political power and economic power, and being a smaller country, one sometimes wonders, like, how do we fit into this international political puzzle, and is it, are we, yeah, in inflating our image, and so you're touching upon like how a small country actually can find a role. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? Not only Norway, but like other countries in the world that are actually, while we're looking at a Macron or a Biden and to save the day, there are all these diplomatic efforts, right, going on with smaller actors.
I think the advantage of being a middle power, and, you know, you are not small. You know, last year, yeah, you were on the Security Council, but St. Vincent and the Grenadines was on the Security Council. And I think their population is around 50,000 people. Yeah.
And they don't have a sovereign wealth fund the size of ours.
They sadly don't have massive amounts of gas to draw on. So you are a middle power. And, you know, I follow what Norway's doing in the UN system. I don't follow what you're doing in NATO as closely, for example. But I think that you have two advantages. Firstly, you have expertise, and you have a lot of people who really know how multilateral organizations work in a way that, funnily, even, you know, the US State Department doesn't have that many people who are sort of dyed-in-the-wool multilateralists, precisely because if you're a US diplomat, you have so many other sort of things to do and sources of power. But you do have that expertise. And secondly, you can afford to fail. And, you know, we highlight the cases where Norway has had some big successes, like Colombia. But, you know, Norwegian officials have also been chipping away, trying to do things to ease the political crisis in Venezuela. And there have been a lot of setbacks. And I think that if you're a Macron, you can't really afford to sort of get into these processes and fail too obviously. Whereas if you're a country like Norway, you can sort of take that risk of failure. And I think that that's actually enormously important.
That's really interesting. I was curious, though, because we spoke before you came into the studio that, you know, we've both taught Security Council issues to students at different times. And we'll get back to that. But you said that you've been working on Security Council issues for 20 years. Why the Security Council? What brought you to this field of expertise?
It wasn't planned. 20 years ago, I was working on Britain's relations with the EU. And, you know, obviously we
that went really well.
Yeah, we sorted out UK-EU relations. Like, well, that's done. What's next? But I got interested in what Europe was trying to do, what the EU was trying to do with sort of crisis management in Africa. And that led me to being interested in the UN. And then actually, it was a Norwegian. It was Espen Barth Eide.
Our current Minister of Climate.
Who he introduced me to some experts working on the UN in New York, and they very kindly said, come over for 2 years, you know, find out what it's like to work around the UN. And 20 years later, I have two American kids, and I've lived in New York for most of my professional life, and I've just sort of lived in the UN world for much longer than I expected.
Also, talking before we entered this studio, we were sort of comparing notes. So, do you know this person, and so on? And we talked about a common friend, and that sort of like just couldn't deal with the system. You know, the system being what it was. While your take was more or less like, well, the system is what it is, and let's try to do the best we can with what we've got, the cards we've been dealt. So obviously, this UN Security Council is, in many ways, not that well-functioning body, political body, and certainly these days. So how do you keep up analyzing the Security Council and knowing that that's just all these things that, that are not working and that won't change either. Isn't that a bit sometimes depressing?
It can be enormously depressing. And, you know, I remember at the start of this year in January and February, when it became very clear that Russia was going to attack Ukraine, just feeling an enormous sense of gloom, because obviously we didn't know how the war would play out, but we knew it was coming. And I had a dreadful sense of foreboding. Then the war starts and suddenly you're focusing on what the Security Council can do, which is not very much, but you know, lots of different UN bodies were debating the war. And the International Crisis Group, where I now work, and my office personally, was sort of jumped into the action, giving all the ideas we could. But that sort of sense of gloom still stays with me. I mean, look, you don't work on the United Nations, ultimately, if you're a super optimistic person. You work on the Security Council in particular if you care about minimizing the things that go badly wrong. So, you know, in Afghanistan, the international community, whatever that means, has failed. We failed all the people of Afghanistan. We've especially failed the women of Afghanistan. Does that mean that we should stop trying to at least ease the suffering of Afghans? No. And so, I mean, I find that I'm drawn to looking at these cases where the UN is here as the last resort and it's trying to minimize suffering. But I would fully understand why someone who was 16 or 20 would look at this and think there must be a better way.
Yeah, because my students are 20. And I last week we did a bigger thing on the Security Council to sort of try to get them to understand the UN system before we do public international law, because the Security Council obviously plays an important role from an international law perspective. And I think it really struck me that when I was starting to study the Security Council myself in, you know, 2005, 2006 in London, it was there was a different feel, you know, when you approach the UN. I read parts of your report on the Ukraine war and UN reform, and you sort of make the point that around that time, the UN was quite shocked, you know, by the war on terror, by the failures in Iraq. But there was a reform process, you know, they took, you know, there was an actual process to sort of reform parts of the UN. You got the Human Rights Council, etc. And so I think, you know, when I started to study the Security Council, there was still a sense of, or the UN in general, there was still a sense of that this is a system that works within the parameters of the world as it is today. But I think some of my 20-year-old students look at this UN today, and especially the Security Council, and they think this doesn't work. You know, what purpose is it serving? This is an outdated 1945 version of the world that we don't recognize today. And I think, you know, from their idealistic perspectives as young would-be lawyers, they look at it and they think, you know, if Russia can sit there and veto after having broken the fundamental rule of public international law, which is do not aggressively, you know, enter another country and breach their sovereignty. If they, as a sitting Security Council member, can do that and veto their way out of any repercussions from a UN setting, you know, how can you say the system is working? And, you know, that's a big question, but, what, you know, you came in around about 2000 then.
Yeah, 2002, yeah. 2003.
Do you feel like there was more space or that the UN was more well-functioning than what it is today? And is it as bad as my students think? It's a big question.
I mean, look, if you go back to 2002, 2003, that was also a period where the UN failed to stop a major power launching an aggressive war, which was the US going into Iraq. So I think a lot of commentary around what Russia is doing in Ukraine sort of slightly leaves out the fact that the UN has faced crises like this before, and in that case, it was Washington that was the aggressor rather than Moscow. But I think what is true is that in the world of 2002, 2003, there was still a bit of a sense that this was like a sort of a Lego box that you'd opened up and you'd put the pieces together slightly wrong. But if only you could sort of rearrange the Lego, you could build a more perfect UN. There was still sort of space to think in technocratic terms about how to fix the system. And that was true even after Iraq. I mean, I think now the Syrian war, the long crisis in Ukraine, it has drained, I think, quite a lot of faith in the prospects for sort of really building up global governance. And I think that what gets lost in a lot of the pessimistic analysis is that you still have the UN on the ground in places like Sudan, saving a lot of lives. UN agencies are still, although very imperfect, pretty crucial to easing a lot of crises in places like Yemen. And I think that still has a lot of value. But for those who really want to sort of think of a way of organizing the world better, the technocratic solutions aren't there. I don't think that, I don't think there is a pathway to a Security Council that works as was intended in 1945 right now. And even if you were to completely junk the UN Charter and start over, I don't actually think it would be possible to negotiate even the UN we have because of the tensions we're seeing right at the moment.
That's a very interesting point and certainly a bit gloomy. And I think that a lot of people who listen to podcasts such as this and people like us speaking, they try to look for some bit of positive development. And I guess maybe that's part of the reason that we do podcasts like this, Sophia.
I'm sorry, I'm losing you listeners. As we speak, the numbers are going down.
I think that because we end up like this quite a bit ourselves. However, and I think this also has sort of like maybe a Scandinavian thing, with a welfare state, and we're sort of like constructing this, as you say, like technocratic world that we seemingly improves our lives step by step, and there's sort of like this linear, I don't know, like Martin Luther King, the arch of justice is peaking, in a positive manner, although it takes a long time. So, but are we seeing a setback? Are we seeing sort of history repeating itself? Are we back to scratch somehow? That's a big question.
It's a big question. I think, and I think actually we've mainly been talking about this in the context of Ukraine. Mm. And if you look at the situation with Russia and the system, it is pretty bleak. Although it's worth saying that even the Russians during the Ukrainian war have been willing to cooperate with other powers in a minimal way on dealing with other situations like Afghanistan and Syria. Even the Russians have some interest in keeping the system going. But I think we should look away from Russia a bit, and you have to look at China, because the really big strategic question about the future of the UN is, can this organization keep working in a world where the US is no longer solely dominant and you have a peer competitor in China coming up? And here I think there is a glimmer of hope, which is that the Chinese have clearly decided that the UN is good for them. We're not in a situation like the 1930s when you had powers like Germany and Italy walking out of the League of Nations.
Because that's what some really pessimistic people would say, is that we're in a situation now where the League of Nations obviously predated the UN. Yeah. It failed.
Yeah.
And it failed because the big powers walked out.
Well, we're not seeing that. China is actually leaning into the UN. And now this worries the Americans, it worries the Europeans, because suddenly China is campaigning, often quite successfully, to take some pretty senior jobs in the UN system. Mm. The Chinese, they're less interested, I think, in the Security Council, and they're more interested in sort of what the economic agencies of the UN can do to help their global rise. Now, there are a lot of concerns associated with that, especially about how China wants to minimize the role of human rights in the UN. But nonetheless, in the grand scheme of things, it's better that China is trying to work inside the system rather than following the 1930s path and just walking away and trying to bring the whole system down. So I think that, in 20 years' time, in 30 years' time, there probably will be some sort of UN. And it will have more Chinese characteristics. We don't know how we get there and how we balance all our interests in the process.
That brings up one of the questions that a lot of people who are like us trying to look into, peek into the future and ask what's next. Is Xi Jinping watching what's happening in Ukraine and thinking like, maybe this is a good idea if I do it in a different, smarter way? Or is he thinking that this shows that I should not enter Taiwan, even though Pelosi provoked me?
That question is well above my pay grade. and also, it's hard to, it's hard to sort of monitor that when you focus on the UN, because in the UN system, Taiwan doesn't really exist. It's not something that is discussed in the Security Council. I mean, I would say that, having tried to be positive for a little bit, to get back to the negative, I mean, if there was... If there was a clash over Taiwan, I think that would actually have even more fundamental repercussions for the international system than what we're seeing in Ukraine, because I think it would lead to a Chinese-US rift that would be an enormous challenge to the future of international cooperation. That said, I only follow tangentially the analysts who work on Chinese military planning. I still don't see that it's in Beijing's interests to bring down the entire system.
It's interesting because I spoke to an American diplomat once who said that Russia is the storm and China is climate change, in the sense that, like, you will navigate the storm somehow. Russia is not, it is a declining power. It doesn't have the infrastructure to really challenge the US, to become a superpower again. It's a dwindling power. But China is the game changer. It's as you said, it seems inevitable that in 20 years' time we might be in a situation where we have a multipolar world again, which means that we have more than one superpower. And from a US perspective, the question is then, as you said, and from a European perspective, how do you navigate that power balance? How does that affect our international institutions? Because I think one of the interesting things, and from my perspective, also, I follow this purely as an academic, but my perspective, or what I heard from a lot of people on the ground in Geneva and other places who worked for international organizations, was that especially during the Trump years presidency, the UN diplomatic corps or the US diplomatic corps was weakened, in the sense that they just didn't have diplomats. They didn't have leadership in the State Department. And when you don't have leadership in the State Department and political leadership, you don't have anyone to send out diplomatic instructions. So a lot of US diplomats would sit in Geneva, for example, with all the different organizations that are in Geneva, and they just wouldn't have a mandate to do their jobs. And so they would, they wouldn't end up doing much of anything. And who stepped into that power vacuum? China. All of a sudden, it was, if you were a middle power or smaller power, it was much better for you to go to China, because they could actually get things done at a time when it seemed that parts of the US diplomatic corps was paralyzed. And that's kind of what you're seeing, is you're seeing China step into different spaces in a different way than they maybe were doing 20 years ago. And how that, I've thought a lot about that, how that changes the fundamentals, the fundamental characteristics of our international order in 20 years' time, I think is going to be really interesting to see. Because as you said, there are maybe going to be more some things that are good, and there are maybe going to be less of human rights, different areas. They're going to be downplayed in that situation.
I mean, I think we saw very much the same in New York in the Trump era. Yeah. And yeah, we're talking about the grand arc of history, as you say. But if you talk to most diplomats in New York and you say, what's the single biggest question about the future of the UN? Their answer would be, who wins the 2024 US elections?
Yeah.
Because there is a sense that things were bad with Trump, but actually in part because the European Union, other countries like Norway, sort of lent in and did everything they could to keep the UN system going, the damage was limited and the damage was reversible. So Trump said that the US would leave the World Health Organization over COVID, and it didn't. Trump pulled out of the Paris climate change deal. Biden came back in. But there is a, there's a definite sense that if we have Trump again, or if we have someone who is very Trumpy, then the US will really start to hurt the UN in a more determined way, or just walk away from the UN.
Well, it's funny because the day after the US elections in 2016, I was doing a book project on foreign fighters, which was my research field at the time. And I'd organized a conference. I was still not commenting US politics on TV, which is why I'd made, and this was one of the first conferences I'd put together myself as a young PhD academic. And so we'd settled on a date half a year before, not realizing it was the day after the US election. But all the people coming to that conference were people who worked on, terrorism, war crimes. Most of them had worked in the UN system tangentially in some form. And I remember so well that, the shock of that morning, because most of us had stayed up all night. So we sort of came into this conference at 8 a.m. being like, what is happening with the world? And I remember so well one of the Swedish participants who had been in the Security Council with Sweden under John Bolton. He was like, he just came into the room. He's like, I can't do John Bolton again. I cannot do this again. And it's funny because I think John Bolton would have looked quite good by the end of the Trump era when he came in. I think that was a relief to some people in the international community.
Oh yeah, Bolton has sort of he's not a liberal icon because he's still John Bolton, but he has won points in the US for being more honest about Trump. I remember that night I was in Brooklyn and the entire city went silent. Yeah. I've only once heard a city fall silent in the same way, which was I was once in Brasilia when Brazil lost an important World Cup match. And it was
against Norway, maybe.
No, I think it was against France, actually.
Okay. I remember it was probably even quieter when they lost against Norway, though.
That must just have been very confusing. That was the only time I've heard a city go as silent as New York. The night that Trump won.
And I think that's something we don't talk enough about is that, as you say, for a lot of diplomats on the ground in international organizations, it is that concern for, Biden can go around the world saying we're back, but everyone knows that he has no control over what happens in 2024.
Because he did his sort of tour of Europe saying that, yeah, relax.
We're back. We're back. It's all good.
But it didn't seem that people actually trusted him.
I think people trust him personally.
Yeah, him, but not the fact that America is back forever and all.
He can't guarantee that the US is back, unfortunately.
No. And I mean, if I were a professional diplomat planning my career, I'm not sure that I would sign up to be an ambassador at the UN in 2025 because you could just be on the receiving end of an awful lot of... I'm trying not to say a bad word. You could be on the receiving end of an awful lot of bad stuff if Trump comes back in. And so that is in everyone's minds. That said, I mean, I think we have seen some signs in the last month or two that Biden has found his footing again, and the Republicans are losing their footing over issues like abortion. So yeah. We shouldn't get too fatalistic about this.
But when you think of sort of like deglobalization, and that could be... maybe the U.S., if not pulling out fully of U.N. or NATO, but sort of like being more
isolationist.
There you go. And maybe drilling their oil in Alaska, whatever. And you also can see that the world also, due to security concerns and the experiences from Russia's invasion in Ukraine, start pulling out of deals with China and critical infrastructure, and because we now understand it took us a while that there are security concerns letting China build your 5G network and so on, sort of, and that collides somehow in what we've long believed that trade with
authoritarian regimes.
There you go. helps and even sometimes even forces these countries to liberalize politically. Isn't the lesson that has not worked when it comes to Russia and China, and that we see more de-globalization?
I think the liberal idea that you could sort of change the political DNA of the Chinese Communist Party has proved to be untrue. I think, though, it's important to emphasize that it is still a highly interdependent world. I mean, undoing globalization is not something that happens overnight. And you see this actually in the global ramifications of Russia's war on Ukraine, which is it's a regional war in Europe that is affecting energy prices globally, that's affecting food prices globally. I mean, I wouldn't underestimate the level of interdependence we have today. And I think that even in a period of, you know, conscious decoupling, was that Gwyneth Paltrow's phrase for divorce? even in a period of conscious decoupling, actually, a lot of the trade networks we have and so on will remain in place and will need to be managed. So I think that those common concerns will remain out there.
You said the regional war in Europe, and that made me think of a conversation I had with our Minister for Development when we were at Arendalsuka, which is this sort of big week of democracy with lots of organizations and lots of different debates.
It's Coachella for democracy.
For democracy, yeah. I led a debate for the Red Cross where she made some really interesting remarks about just having been an observing one of the few foreign ministers to observe the African Union's top meeting this year. And she said that what really struck her was that from a European and from a Western perspective, we think that the whole world agrees with our perspective on the Ukraine crisis. You know, we think that everyone understands that Russia's the aggressor and that this is a fundamental war that's changing the character of an international system. Whereas what she says she's experiencing is that when you go to other parts of the world, there's somewhat of a resentment to the fact that Europe is reacting at this level to the Ukraine war. You know, when you know, from a more global perspective, you know, where's that kind of thoughtfulness been with regards to a lot of armed conflict in, for example, Africa, Syria for that matter, and so on. You know, and secondly, that while, you know, for them, this is a regional war in Europe that doesn't necessarily have the massive ramifications that we, from a Western perspective, think that it has. And, you know, they're still very open to working with Russia. How do you see this from a... And she said, you know, she's worried that we're sort of living in these two realities, not realizing that for a lot of the world, they don't see the Ukraine war the same way that we do. And that by not understanding that, we're giving China and Russia a space to do work, you know, building up their narrative of the conflict and the sort of world order that they would want, because we're not engaging with ourselves in, you know, in explaining this or in bringing countries into what our perspectives, because we think it's so obvious. You know, is that something that resonates with you from what you're seeing in the UN?
Oh, there's a split? Absolutely. And if you go back to the early months of the war, I think that Western countries miscalculated quite badly because they kept pressing African countries, Arab countries, to condemn Russia. And then at a pretty early stage, African diplomats started to say, we're very worried about what this war means for global food prices and our economies. And we're very worried about what it means for international aid flows, because Western countries are going to divert money to Ukraine and away from Africa and other developing regions. And the initial European response in particular was, yeah. Don't worry us with that. This is a war like no other war. Yeah. We just need you to support us.
And get in line.
And there were stories of European diplomats going into meetings on sea level rise in the Pacific and saying, before we talk about sea level rise, we need to talk about Ukraine. And I mean, if you come from an island in the Pacific that is sinking, that is not a great message to hear. I think it's got better. I think actually this is one thing the Biden administration has got right. The Biden administration moved quite quickly to address concerns about global food security, to show that they understand why those concerns are, you know, are very pressing. But even so, you know, we definitely are seeing a sort of a battle to control the narrative about what is happening in Ukraine, where, you know, you have Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, goes to Russia, then Blinken from Washington, not goes to Russia, goes to Africa, then Blinken goes to Africa. I think I think that there's still a huge battle to persuade the world that our version of what's going on in Ukraine is the correct one.
Yeah, because I think that was an interesting perspective, because she said that, you know, especially from a Norwegian perspective, we just think everyone understands, you know, what this is like, you know, given that we neighbor Russia. But that's just not, you know, it gave me food for thoughts for 2 weeks now. I've been thinking about that.
Yeah, because one of the sort of things that we sort of look upon and think that it's there's a certain positivity to it is the fact that we've sort of rallied around the concept of democracy, at least in the liberal Western democratic world, and the faith in institutions such as the EU, NATO, and the UN. And maybe that is also something that Putin miscalculated that we would do, and maybe he thought that we would split more. But there is certainly, as you say, a divide here with the rest of the world. So how do you see, another big question, Richard? Sorry. how do you see sort of the concept of democracy going forward here? Are we actually able to sell it? Obviously, we weren't able to do it in the Middle East. So I mean, what is the value of democracy these days in the world?
I mean, you know, it's worth saying that countries' positions on Ukraine are not dictated by whether or not they're democratic. I mean, the Indians, what I think the world's largest democracy by population, have been very careful to maintain good ties with Russia, despite appeals from the West to alienate Moscow. And similarly, a lot of African democracies are still tilting towards Russia. I mean, I think that it's enormously appealing to try and frame this as democracy versus authoritarianism, but it simply doesn't capture the realities and interests of a lot of non-Western countries who have strong economic relations with China, security relations with Russia, and just don't see these issues in the black and white terms that I think some Western commentators would like to frame them. And this is not so much of a problem for Norway, but it is also worth saying that, you know, the legacy of colonialism did not somehow get deleted in 2000 with the arrival of the new millennium. I think what I hear from a lot of non-Western diplomats at the UN is that actually there is still a lot of memories of how the Soviet Union supported liberation struggles against Western countries. You know, those feelings, rightly or wrongly, are still there and affecting how they view this crisis.
But we are forgiven for the Viking Age.
If you go to the northeast of England, there's still a lot of resentment.
So we're trying to land this now. These huge issues, and I'd like to end with something very concrete and equally difficult, though. How will the war in Ukraine end, do you think? And when? It seems to be no end in sight. If you follow the UN from the outside, you're following the UN more or less from the inside. What's your take?
I certainly don't think that anyone at the UN knows the answer to that. And the reality is that it's very easy to write, and this comes back to our discussion of technocratic solutions. You can write a very easy sort of technocratic sort of plan for a peace process. There would be a ceasefire. Maybe the UN would send some observers to check that the ceasefire sticks. There would be further peace talks. But the reality is right now, there's a strong feeling in Ukraine, amongst the public, that Ukraine is winning and shouldn't give up. And as far as we can tell, President Putin believes that he's winning. And I think the answer is you will get to a situation where at least a pause in hostilities is possible when both sides feel exhausted. Now, when does that come? We cannot say. I've heard UN diplomats say the end of the year, or maybe it will be next spring. But I think that's all mainly guesswork. My assumption is that at some point, both sides will become exhausted. There will be a pause in hostilities, but there's also a risk that you have a pause in hostilities, even with some sort of formal political agreement, and then it turns out to be just
scam.
For a few years.
Yeah.
And then the war will sort of pick up again when both sides have recovered. But right at the moment, it comes down to what's going on the battlefield. And the reality is very few of us really know what is happening on the battlefield, on the southern front around Kherson or on the eastern front right at the moment.
But, you know, there's nothing that indicates that this is going to be a short conflict at this point. You know, given that, as you say, it seems at the present time to be a question of when both sides will feel like they have so depleted, you know, manpower, not least weapon stocks. And then we'll think, okay, we can maybe go in for some sort of informal ceasefire at this point, you know, and then yeah. see what happens next. But that's, as you say, probably going to take at least, you know, some time. Because we spoke when we started this podcast because of the invasion of Ukraine, you know, we thought, and there have been at times publicly as well speak of some sort of peace agreement, but that's not something that's being discussed at the UN anymore.
I think the reality is that because there's such a big power imbalance between Russia and Ukraine at the UN, that even if there is a moment where peace is possible, it's not going to be negotiated in New York.
Right.
It will be negotiated somewhere else. I mean, you know, Turkey continues to play a certain sort of right. facilitating role. And you know, this is all hypothetical, but if there was a peace agreement, it would be made away from New York. But I can imagine that everyone would probably say, yeah, we need to bring this to the Security Council, you know, to be sort of formalized. So my guess is that the UN will have some sort of role at the end of the war, if there is a chance to end it. But the peace process will not start on First Avenue. It will start in sort of some shadowy conference rooms in places far away.
And apologizing to my former colleagues in the foreign ministry that it has been a while since I was sitting around your office tables trying to make the world a better place to be. I do remember, though, that when people looked to Norway and our population, help us solve this and this crisis, we sort of try to say, because it's easy to say that we are like a peace facilitator, but that all depends on that. I remember the term, like the parties have to be motivated. It's not that we're running around the world with the missing piece of a political puzzle. Because we're Norwegians, it's because we were able to facilitate. People can go here in secrecy and negotiate. And as you said, we can afford to fail. So it seems that we need to wait until Russia and Ukraine are motivated, and as you say, exhausted. Unfortunately,
I think that's right. I mean, there have also been studies that show that it is worth trying and failing to get peace agreements, that actually just the process of making people who are fighting talk about what circumstances they would make peace under can sort of help gradually build up the framework for an eventual agreement. So it requires a lot of patience and a lot of persistence, but yeah, it does involve a lot of failure.
One last question, which probably won't be the last question anyway. we're talking about institutions, about systems. What about people? Obviously, these are people sitting down around the table, and we've all followed and maybe been a bit surprised and certainly impressed by a person like Zelensky. How important are people to peace solutions in the world?
I think
him in especial.
Yeah, no, I think that if you look at a lot of peace processes, it's often a leader who sort of is willing to take risks, who can make peace. And, you know, clearly in this context, you have Zelensky on the one hand, but you have Putin on the other hand. And, you know, Putin's personal control of decision making is such that I think one reason that previous sort of peace talks between the Russians and Ukrainians haven't got very far is that the Russians sitting at the table have not been well connected to Putin. So they don't really have any.
They don't have a mandate to actually.
No, they're not serious in that sense. I think with Zelensky, though, it's worth saying, based on my discussions with crisis groups experts, you know, working on this day in, day out, you know, he also has to respond to public opinion. And right now, as I said, public opinion in Ukraine is strongly in favor of continuing the war. And Zelensky, unlike Putin, is a democratic leader. And if he were to try and cut a unsustainable peace agreement, he would probably fall very, very quickly. So he, you know, he does matter hugely as an individual. And in New York, everyone is wondering if he's going to come to the UN General Assembly in September, which would be an amazing moment, although probably unlikely, as it would be dangerous for him to leave his country. But, you know, he is still answering to a popular mood, which we sometimes forget.
And I think that's really interesting because I gave an interview this summer to the Defense magazine, which I got some criticism for because I said they asked me, you know, what's your perspective on what's happening in Ukraine right now? And I said that what I'm the most curious about is exactly how Zelensky is going to have to navigate some of these incredibly difficult dilemmas that you have to navigate in trying to get your country out of this conflict situation. And just in terms of, you know, he's gone out publicly, you know, called what's happened a genocide, war crimes, you know, wants war crimes prosecutions. That's what I study. I would obviously like to see those mechanisms myself. But if he is going to approach Russia and broker some sort of sustainable peace agreement, you know, you and I both know that the idea that the Russians are ever going to support any kind of accountability mechanism, you know, it's probably going to be off the table from the start. There are going to be some very difficult choices that he has to make in reality during those sorts of negotiations. And as you said, he is a democratically elected leader. I don't see it being palatable to the Ukrainian public when there have been such strong calls for prosecutions, and they've already indeed begun prosecutions of Russian soldiers. It's going to be very, I mean, I think we've talked a lot about him as a leader and the international leadership that he's shown in this crisis. But I think the maybe the most difficult leadership challenge that he will face is selling any kind of peace agreement to the public. You know, is saying to the public, hey, this is the best that I could do under these terms. And I know that you still want to fight and I know this and this and that, but this is what I think is the right path forward. And that is hard when you are a democratically elected leader in this kind of crisis.
It's true, but I mean, things might change if, for example, the current Ukrainian offensive scores some sort of limited but clear successes. It may be easier at that point for Zelensky to start saying, like, you know, we are now winning on the battlefield. We can start to negotiate because we're negotiating from a position of some strength and having shown that we can actually beat the Russians. But I mean, these are all hypotheticals.
Yeah.
And I fully agree with what you said 5-10 minutes ago. This is now broadly a war of attrition, and unless one side can somehow suddenly break things open, it's got a while to run.
So Richard, since you're here and we've analyzed the world in so many ways already, we're gonna end this as we always do with a recommendation. And in fact, one of the things that we've recommended, at least I have, at least twice,
I've also recommended it.
is sort of our big brother in the UK, which is The
Podcast.
Rest is Politics with Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart. Something that you listen to?
I've listened to it a bit, not as much as I should, but ironically, I was actually in the same youth drama group as Rory Stewart. The guy who played McNulty in The Wire.
No!
Dominic West.
Dominic West. So,
and you did not go into either theater or politics.
I feel I'm probably the less famous member of that drama group, but you've got me.
What kind of drama did you do?
Mainly very bad drama. I think Dominic West, it's probably right that he is the one who's gone on to Hollywood fame.
Yeah. Well, The Wire is one of our favorite shows. So yeah,
and Dominic West would be actually, could he work in politics? He certainly has the presence.
I think that if you've got a choice between total make-believe and being in Hollywood, I would go for Hollywood, because at the moment, most British politics is total make-believe.
And speaking about that, does Rory Stewart have a political future, or is there no way to beat Liz Truss as these days as the new party leader for the Conservatives?
We're going to find out next week who your new prime minister is.
Yeah.
Exciting.
I think that there's a sense now that the political turmoil in the UK is ending because Johnson is on his way out, but actually that's incorrect. I think that we're in for quite a lot more turmoil, at least until the next general election and quite possibly beyond.
Is this just a new Maggie Thatcher?
I should not comment on the politics of my home country, but she could be prime minister for a very short period of time. So we will see.
We shall follow it closely in this podcast.
As will I.
Yeah. So back to the recommendation. Richard, what is your recommendation of the week?
So this is self-serving, but...
That's also very, we encourage that, yeah.
You make it sound like a bad thing, Richard.
Okay, if I can be self-serving, in about 2 weeks' time, when I finished writing it, my organization, the International Crisis Group, will publish something called 10 Challenges for the UN in the Year Ahead.
Perfect.
And it's worth reading because it's not just about Ukraine, although obviously Ukraine is quite prominent. But we look at what the UN is doing in other places like Honduras or Yemen, which get a lot less attention, but it's quite concise. So it's worth reading. And what have I enjoyed watching this summer? I think, like everyone else, it was Top Gun. And I think what's wonderful about Top Gun is that it has united everyone who works on foreign policy, from the military guys to the multilateralists, because it's just fun. And if you haven't seen it, what have you been doing this summer?
I went to the cinema and I saw it and I really enjoyed it, because a friend of mine was like, he loves Top Gun. He's like, we have to go see this. It's going to be so great. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure about this. And I really, really loved it. I loved it.
I saw Top Gun this week with two former colleagues at the embassy in Washington, in fact. And I was warned by my 19-year-old son and said that it's fairly predictable and a lot of, full of cliches. And I was like, that's why we're watching it. Come on. In a world that is not predictable these days, unfortunately.
I watched it in a cinema in New York, and there was an old lady in the cinema as well who... occasionally would just shout, "It's Tom Cruise!" And no one minded, because it's Tom Cruise. And in an uncertain world, what you need is Tom Cruise.
That's perfect.
That's a perfect end of the episode. Thank you so much, Richard, for being with us today and for your valuable work in analyzing and promoting the work in the UN Security Council.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's enough. Put down the mic.
Nå gjør vi det litt enklere og billigere for deg å spise litt sunnere I hverdagen. Derfor starter vi Rema 1000 vårsesongen med å kutte prisene på over 100 sunnere varer. Og vi stopper ikke der. Nå får du også 500 gram laksefilet uten skinn til bare 89,90. Og diverse salatmikser til 14,90 per stykk. For det slutsummen på kassalappen som teller. Hos Rema 1000.
Nå lanserer vi I Meny vår nye kundeklubb, Meny Mer. Som Meny Mer-kunde får du mer tromfbonus på nye produkter hver uke, og 10% tromfbonus på din første handel. Og I hele sommer får du 30% tromfbonus på over 200 produkter fra Jakobs utvalgte. Så bli Meny Mer-kunde I dag og få flere fordeler når du handler hos oss. Meny, spiser du bedre, lever du bedre. Just